Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Excuse me, I pressed the wrong button, and that was just a wee bit of a promo for the hour that is to come. This hour of our program, Bill McKibben is our guest. He has a brand new book, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. We have a lot to talk to him about. He says early in the book that he thinks that he's learned more in the past 2 years than in all the decades that came before, so we'll be sure and ask him about the last 2 years. Some of that education and the tumult and conflict of his own life as he helped to build an active resistance to the fossil fuel industry. And some came in the bee yards of his home state, where he carefully watched a very different, very beautiful way of dealing with a malfunctioning modernity. Bill is speaking tonight in Oconomowoc. His latest book is Oil and Honey. He's going to be at the Arts Center there. He's the author, of course, of a number of books, starting with The End of Nature, published in 1989, and regarded as the first book for a general audience on climate change. He founded this amazing grassroots climate campaign, 350.org. Since 2009, that campaign has coordinated 15,000 rallies in 189 countries. He's also author of The Age of Missing Information. Be sure and remind me to ask him about that later in the interview, because it was an amazing thing he did. He's written many, many books, is a contributor to various magazines, New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, Mother Jones, the list goes on. He helped lead a five-day walk across Vermont to demand action on global warming. And his latest book tells us about his environmental work all over the world and also his interest in beekeeping. We'll be welcoming phone calls. They're already coming in for Bill. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Bill. Thanks so much for being with us.
Friend, it's a pleasure as always.
Yeah, great to have you here. And there's so much to talk about. But let's start, because I found this intriguing for somebody to say, I've learned more in the last 2 years than in all the decades previous. What in the world went on the last 2 years?
Well, I did learn a lot. I mean, at least I learned a lot about how politics and power and things work. You know, I'd written the first book about climate change, as you said, and I think at the time, when I was in my 20s, 25 years ago when I did that, I was thinking, well, this is my contribution, you know, I will lay out this case. And I think I was naive enough then to think, you know, people will read my book and then they will change. That's actually, as it turns out, not precisely how change happens. In fact, it doesn't seem to happen with the constant application of reason. For 25 years, scientists and economists have been going up to Capitol Hill and saying, look, the worst thing that ever happened on the planet's happening, this ongoing, you know, accelerating change in the climate. And here's what we need to do to deal with it. We need to put a serious price on carbon so that we don't have one industry that gets to pollute for free and tilt the playing field in a dramatic way. For 25 years, they've been doing that. And for 25 years, there's been no response. I mean, there's basically been a bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing. And it's been entirely successful. Maybe not surprising to think about this week, when doing nothing in Washington has become the absolute sport of sports. But at a certain point, it began to dawn on me that we were going to need, beyond having won the argument, if we were going to win the fight, we were probably going to need some power. It wasn't going to come from money. The fossil fuel industry has more of it than anyone on Earth. So we'd have to find some other currencies to work in, the currencies of movement, passion, spirit, creativity. That's why we started 350.org, which has now held 15 or 20,000 rallies in every country on Earth except North Korea. And it's why in the last 2 years we've taken as much of that energy as we can and in this country tried to focus it on a couple of really what have become iconic fights, one over the Keystone Pipeline and the other over this very widespread drive to get colleges and churches and cities to divest their holdings in these companies that are really now a rogue industry determined to pump more carbon into the atmosphere than even the most conservative governments or scientists say would be safe.
What's the latest on the Keystone? I was reading today that it looks as though a decision is going to be put off until next year. Has the environmental statement been written? Is the president going to act, about to act?
Well, I'm actually the wrong person. I don't have much inside information. I was arrested for chaining myself to the outside of the White House along with 1,253 other people. But the last time I was inside the White House was a tour in sixth grade, I think. So,
know about you on the inside.
I don't have much inside information. When we started 2 years ago, this thing was a done deal. This pipeline from the tar sands down to the Gulf was a done deal. Nobody thought that there was any possibility of stopping it. It's no longer a done deal. I mean, I'd say we're probably 50-50 at this point, continuing to press hard. We had 217 demonstrations in 47 states the weekend before last. I was in Seattle with a few thousand people drawing the line, they called it, against Keystone. It's become the iconic environmental fight of our time. If the president does the right thing, it'll be the first time that any world leader has said, here's a big project we won't build because of its effect on the climate. And that would be very useful, be very important. I think along with its importance in keeping a lot of oil underground in the tar sands, it would also be a signal to the rest of the planet that it's time to start negotiating seriously again about global warming. Something that effectively hasn't happened since the collapse of those talks in Copenhagen in 2009. So it's a real test, and it'll be interesting to find out.
He gives little bitty indications every now and then, and I think you could probably safely say that because of your protests, which attracted attention and must have attracted the attention of the White House, this decision has been delayed. It could have been made much earlier.
No, I mean, everybody expected it, in the summer of 2011. So, I mean, we've kept it bottled up for a couple of years now, and that's kept 900,000 barrels of oil a day in the ground. So that's worth a few days in jail, But we're very hopeful that he will rise to the occasion. We're also worried that it'll be one more of these cases where he talks big and acts tiny.
When we look at the enormity of the issue, Bill, and I think probably 99% of people on Earth realize how incredibly important this is. It is probably the most important issue of our lifetimes. Why in the world wouldn't anybody recognize that? A prime minister, a president? It's our very survival.
Well, I mean, the reason is, I think, that the fossil fuel industry is so tied into our economies and our politics that it's difficult. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's difficult physically to kick it, though not as difficult as it was to imagine a few years ago. I mean, the replacement technology gets better all the time. There were days this summer when the Germans generated more than half the power they used from solar panels within their borders.
Hmm.
Yeah. And this is Germany. I mean, there's a few people of German extraction who've made their way to Wisconsin over the years, and I think they will testify that for all its charms, abundant sunshine is not one of Germany's main features. And yet they have a natural resource that really has been helpful, political will. There are more solar panels in Bavaria than there are in the United States.
No.
So that's a pretty good depiction. I mean, think what a country could do that had, Florida, California, Texas, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, California to work with. We might get somewhere. But it's hard for, the economic power embedded in the fossil fuel industry is so great that it's very difficult to overcome it without a huge push from the rest of society. They're the 800-pound gorillas. And, look at our politics. It's people like the Koch brothers that, oil and gas barons that dominate our political life.
And certainly are contributing to the gridlock in Washington right now in a large way.
Yes.
The other part of the book is this phenomenal story of a man who turned out to be your neighbor. You read an essay of his at one point, and it was a beekeeper who's living on a phenomenally low amount of money every year and is living off the grid, and it's a wonderful story. Why were you captivated by him and by beekeeping?
Well, Kirk Webster is a great character and a neighbor in Vermont. aunt and someone I really love, and I wanted to tell his story. He was the first really chemical-free apiarist in the country. And as you know, beehives are in bad shape these days. There was a story in the Times a couple of months ago saying half the beehives in America may have died last year. Kirk's actually very successful. He pioneered a lot of interesting ways of doing things, and I wanted to write about that. But mostly I wanted to kind of just use him as a vehicle to get across one of the promising things that's happening, the emergence of these local networks around food and energy and sufficiency in many ways. Vermont, where I live, is kind of ahead of the curve in many ways in this, and it's beautiful to see and makes me very heartened. It also makes me very scared because we have to work on both the local and the global level. Our beautiful experiments in local living, many of them got washed away 2 years ago when Hurricane Irene dropped more water on Vermont than has ever been dropped, the kind of rainfall you can only have now that we've increased the temperature and hence made the atmosphere hold more water. And, you know, we lost roads and bridges, but we also lost an awful lot of the beautiful organic farms in the river bottoms. Mm. In a matter of minutes, they went from farm to sand and rock. And so, when I'm home, I'm deeply attracted to being there and at the same time understand that we've got to do some work out in the big world to have any hope of holding on to the places we love.
And the signs are so obvious, aren't they? If you just look at the last month, the news is dominated by fires in California, by incredible floods in various parts of the country. We've never been through a time where there have been so many floods, have we?
And last summer, I think, was the one, summer 2012, that really should have kicked it in for Americans. This was by far the warmest year in American history, 2012. And we saw across the Midwest, you know, that it simply got too hot to grow grain.
It was hot.
If it's too hot in the Midwest to grow corn, what does that tell you about the future of the Earth? We've raised the temperature of the planet about 1 degree so far, 1 degree Celsius, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. The scientists who told us that would happen tell us that we're going to raise the temperature on our current pace 3, 4, 5 degrees, so 6, 7, 8 degrees Fahrenheit in the course of this century. And what they also tell us is from this point on, each degree increase in global average temperature should cut global grain yields about 10%. I.e., if you raise temperature 3 degrees, you got about 30% fewer calories on the planet to go around. This is by far the biggest thing that humans have ever done, and we're not facing up to the fact that we're changing things on a geological timescale. We're beginning to. It's heartening to see these movements spread. There was a study from Oxford yesterday saying that the divestment movement from fossil fuel is the fastest growing divestment movement ever, even faster than around apartheid in South Africa a generation ago. And they said it represents this was funded in part, I think, by HSBC, the huge bank. It said this represents the biggest threat to the fossil fuels industry's domination of our politics around the world. So that made us feel good and heartened and to continue to push hard.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Bill. Bill McKibben is our guest this hour. We're delighted to have him here. He's speaking tonight in Oconomowoc at the Arts Center, and he'll be talking about Keystone Pipeline. He'll be talking about global warming. He'll be talking about keeping bees. He'll talk about how he became really an unlikely activist. And I would imagine this work is not only exhausting, but for a person who likes to write, he's suddenly become very much in the focus of millions of people all over the world and politicians, etc. So it's not an easy life. His latest book is Oil and Honey, just published, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill McKibben is our guest, and we go to phone calls for him. Edwin is our first caller in Four Corners. Hi, Edwin.
Yes, hello. Hey, Bill. I heard you on OJIB radio up here when you did the race in Hayward and finished in 3 hours and 50 minutes.
Up at the Birkebeiner. That was a great day, and it was a great day to be, as always,
right.
on WOJB. Well, that's a up there in that's Couture. That's a wonderful radio station, and it's a wonderful part of the world.
Yeah, and thanks for coming to our neighborhood up here. So, well, Bill, I just as background, so I live in a 450-square-foot shack, no hot water, no television, no internet, no cell phone. I use 1 kilowatt of electricity a month.
Wow.
With the growing world population demanding more and more modern conveniences, in order to reduce our global footprint to 350 parts per million, I think the Kyoto Accord said that we would have to reduce, the United States would have to reduce our carbon emissions by 90% by the year 2045. And, you know, I just wanted to get your thoughts on how we would do that. And whether that's a realistic goal, you know, especially with everybody wanting a cell phone and all the conveniences. And so, and then, you know, when you look at that, we're talking about a transformation of society and returning to the old ways and moving away from the concept of growth. And I just wanted your reflections on that. Thank you very much, and I'll listen off the air.
Thanks, Edwin.
Well, I mean, these are great and deep questions. Is it realistic to dramatically cut our energy use by 2045? It's difficult. It's hard. It'll be about the hardest thing we've ever done on a scale, you know, to require a kind of effort like the one we put into preparing for World War II, say. But that begs the question of what realistic means. What's really not realistic is trying to outwit physics, you know. That's who our adversary in the end in this fight is. It's told us how much carbon we could safely have in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million, a number we're well past now, closing in on 400, up about 2 parts per million per year. And the results are clear. The Arctic is melting. The ocean is acidifying more rapidly than it has for 300 million years. The atmosphere, as I said, is 5% wetter, loading the dice for drought and for flood. And that's just the beginning. So political realism is tough. Real realism is even tougher in this case. And we're going to have to, if we can, use our political system to make those changes. As I said, the technology like sun and wind is more available now than we thought it would be, but that doesn't mean it'll be simple to switch to it. It'll be hard, not as hard as dealing with what comes if we don't do it.
So now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to add in these sort of questions of growth and things. I think the world that we build will be different, and I think the reason it'll be different is because these are different energy sources. Instead of being concentrated in a few places like oil or coal, sun and wind are spread out. They're everywhere, but they're diffuse. So there'll be no John D. Rockefeller of wind or sun. It'll be a different scene and a different world, and hopefully one that, among other things, will be more democratic, more decentralized, work better in a lot of ways. But physics is the imperative here.
The political system has to deal with this. For heaven's sake, Bill, we have a political system that can't even keep the government open now.
Well, this is the discouraging, I got to say. There are moments when one spends too much time in Washington. You know, the House and Senate have taken a series of kind of test votes on this Keystone Pipeline, for instance, over the years. And you can predict with stunning and really horrifying accuracy how any representative or senator will vote based on how much money they took from the fossil fuel industry. It's even better indicator than their party ID or anything. And that's disgusting. I grew up more or less a patriotic soul. I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, the birthplace of American liberty. And I used to go in the summers. My summer job was giving tours of the Battle Green in my tricorn hat. You know, so I have a kind of naive patriotism, and a lot of it's been scotched by watching, you know, the last few years in D.C. It is pretty gross. The only good thing to be said about it is that that kind of calculus of power, that you can trump their money if you show up with enough bodies, you know. If you can throw some political fear into them, then there's possibility. But it shouldn't have to be that way. You know, in a working system, reason would long ago have pushed us in the direction we need to go.
Carl is next in Madison. Hello.
Yes, hello. First of all, Kathleen, thank you for a program of great integrity. That's a rare resource in media these days. And I just want to say to anybody listening, whatever you may care about, whatever causes you may want to move in the direction of, a healthy and sustainable planet certainly undergirds all of those. You know, scientists have been telling us for a long time, you know, the problems that we face now and the problems that we will face if we don't stop dumping so much CO2 into the atmosphere. And their voices are being joined by farmers, naturalists, and others who pay attention to weather patterns for their livelihood, and still the political leadership lags dangerously far behind. And it seems that, at least in our country, a change on these enormous issues, issues like civil rights and certainly this issue, have required, you know, the people themselves to come to the fore, often rallying behind leaders who have proven themselves capable of articulating the, both the problem and the way forward in addressing it. And Bill McKibben, I want to say thank you very much for the courage, the challenge that you've taken on in becoming one of those leaders. I'll be there in Oconomowoc tonight. And I just wanted to say that publicly and also ask you, you know, what do you find most challenging about this moment in history right now with this undecided Keystone Pipeline issue? And what do you find most hopeful about what you're seeing going on around the country?
Thank you, Carl.
Yes, thank you very much, Carl. The challenge, of course, is the dysfunction of our political system in the face of great need. The hope is, and it really is a strong hope, this quick growth of this movement to do something about it. You know, we had the biggest climate rally in history in February on the Mall in D.C., and it was pretty dramatic. We had the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years about anything on this Keystone fight. We sent 800,000 emails to the Senate in the course of a single day and a million written comments into the State Department about Keystone. It's been pretty dramatic to see, and what's really nice about it is that it's a different kind of movement. We're not really in the 60s anymore, and so there's no great charismatic leader, no Dr. King, no central organization like the NAACP or something. Instead, it's a very vast, sprawling, spread-out resistance. And a lot of it's, you know, centered on local concerns, but is easily networked into also being in contact with everybody and able to talk about global things. So, you know, earlier this summer, I remember being out in the Mackinac Bridge there, you know, and they wanted, there's a oil pipeline down beneath, you know, in between where the lakes meet there, and they want to run tar sands oil through it. And so people were upset about that, but they also understood that they were part of this fight about climate. A couple of days later, I was in Richmond, California, outside the Chevron headquarters. So local people were leading this protest because 15,000 of them had to go to the hospital when this refinery leaked a couple of years ago. But there were also a lot of people there from Ecuador because Chevron has done real damage to the forest there in the search for oil. And there were lots and lots of people from the sort of larger climate movement because, you know, Chevron's a textbook case of this kind of irresponsibility. They gave the largest single corporate campaign donation since Citizens United. They gave it 2 weeks before the last election to make sure that the House would stay in the hands of climate deniers, and they were successful. You know, everybody was there to say on a local, on a regional, on a global basis, this is unacceptable. And the ability to kind of build that sort of sprawling, decentralized movement's important because the fossil fuel industry is sprawling and decentralized and in every place. But the movement we're trying to build, it kind of looks like the energy system we want to build. No, not a few big power plants someplace, but millions of solar panels on millions of rooftops, all interconnected. We'll see if we can build it out fast enough.
And the amazing thing is, and I guess it's because of the internet, Bill, is that you have built this movement that literally is all over the world. It's amazing.
The internet is kind of a wild card. Now, we're careful to not sort of use it. Just sending e-petitions back and forth to each other isn't really that useful. So we use it to make things happen in the real world and have these huge global days of action. Mm-hmm. And there's more of that all the time. We just trained 500 young people from 135 countries for 2 weeks in Istanbul. 5,000 had applied to come to this training. We could only take 500. But they're now, you know, out in teams of six or seven all over the world in their home countries, causing good trouble in lots of places. And as that sort of thing continues and grows, it looks like the fossil fuel industry is so big and powerful and invulnerable. But I wouldn't really want to be in their shoes right now. I think that their day is almost over.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the coal industry has taken it on the chin the last few years because it's the dirtiest of them all. But the oil guys are close behind. As we look at things like the tar sands, people are starting to understand just what kind of extreme destruction of the planet we now have to undergo now that the easy oil is out of the ground. If we're determined to keep sucking up the stuff, we're really going to have to do deep, deep damage to the planet, not just in climate terms, but also in all the places this stuff comes from. I was up in Alberta in the tar sands this past summer. And we did this with First Nations people up there, did this walk across the tar sands. It's unbelievable. For Tolkien fans, you know, the technical name of this place, I think, is Mordor. I mean, it is as ugly as it is possible to imagine, and a pretty good symbol. There's some of the biggest tailing ponds in the world. Where the water that's been polluted in this process goes to be held, I guess, forever behind dams. And all the time you're up there, wherever you are, you can hear going off, boom, 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 every few seconds, a cannon. And the reason is that they have to keep scaring away any birds that might land in this stuff because they die instantly. But it really feels like a kind of, like there's a war against nature going on up there and nature is losing. And it's a pretty condensed version of what's going on the planet as a whole.
Yeah. Let's go to Cindy next in Verona. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, thanks. I have an atmospheric science degree myself, so I certainly understand your dismay with what's been happening over the past 20 years. I just wanted to offer an analogy that might be useful for you or for other listeners when confusion over this issue comes up, especially with regards to the extremes we've been seeing, extreme heat, extreme cold, the sort of the fronts that come across and that are so dramatic. And that's that if you think of a pot of water on the stove, if anyone's ever watched a pot of water, waited for it to boil, as you watch the water, the swirls and the eddies become more and more dramatic, deeper, until the pot finally reaches a full rolling boil, and that is essentially what's going on in our atmosphere right now. These swirls and eddies with the frontal systems get more dramatic and bigger. The extremes get more extreme, and we're headed for a full rolling boil on the Earth. So some folks might find that useful. Just wanted to offer that.
I think that's a really powerful analogy. It is hard for us to understand that the things that we're doing, which in each of them are small in aggregate, add up. It was easy to understand that setting off a few big nuclear bombs could change everything because we could sort of see it in our mind's eye, the mushroom cloud. Harder to understand that the explosion of a billion pistons every minute and a billion cylinders across the world might do the same level of damage. But that's where we are. Another way to think about it is we're taking hundreds of billions of years or hundreds of millions of years worth of biology, all those dead dinosaurs and plankton and ferns and things, and tossing them all into the atmosphere in the course of a few decades. It would be a miracle if it wasn't having huge effect on everything around us. And of course it is. I mean, it's having an effect that will be measured in geologic time. And it's, you know, one way to say it is that probably the most important thing that's happened in the lifetime of everybody listening is that our planet has left behind the Holocene, this 10,000-year period of benign climatic stability that underwrote the rise of human civilization. Everybody that we know about, have any record of, lived during a period of what scientists call the Holocene, when the temperature stayed stable and the sea level stayed stable and all of that. Sometime in the last 20 years, we crossed some line and went out of that. And now we're in something new, and the question is how far and how deep we're going to go into it.
Since money seems to play a big part in all of this, the money that lobbyists from these industries are giving to politicians, I mean, it's huge. It's a huge factor. But I'm thinking lately about the amount of money that it's taking to rebuild New York, the New Jersey Shore after Sandy, to rebuild Vermont and all the people who lost their farms,
it's
to rebuild.
It's starting to add up.
Well, doesn't it? Doesn't it?
Doesn't
that play in?
Last year, the federal government spent more money coming up, you know, repairing things after the Midwest drought and Sandy than the federal government spent on education. So,
really?
You know, you're starting to eat your seed corn. But the problem is, I mean, the fossil fuel industry's figured out the perfect scam. I mean, they get to keep, they privatize the profit and they socialize the costs. You know, we didn't bill Exxon for Sandy. We billed every taxpayer. And that's, in essence, what we need, what every economist left, right, and center has said for decades now that we need is a price on carbon that would reflect the damage it was doing. And if we had that, we'd be moving very quickly to other things. We can't get that until we break the political power of this industry, hence fights like this fast-spreading divestment fight that are designed, really, to weaken their ability to dominate our political life.
And tell me more about the divestment fight. What success have you had in this country?
Sure. We started about 8 or 9 months ago. And so far, I mean, it's, as I say, they've described it as the fastest growing social movement in the student movement in many years. 380 college campuses are now have fully engaged fights about this. We've won on 7 or 8 of them already. Others have said no. Harvard said no this week, and students immediately said, okay, good. That gives us the chance now to really campaign in earnest, you know. 15 or 16 big cities have now divested their holding, Seattle, San Francisco, Portland, Providence, and increasing number of religious denominations here and around the world. The Uniting Church in Australia, which is their big Protestant denomination, the Anglican dioceses of New Zealand. Earlier this year in this country, the United Church of Christ, which is our oldest Protestant, they sort of trace themselves back to the Pilgrims, you know, and they said, look, it's not okay to pay the pastor by investing in companies that are running Genesis backward. We're through playing, you know, being their political allies. We're going to neutralize ourselves here, step out of this, not take the side of the Chevrons and the Shells and the Exxons. If we're going to take any side, it'll be the side of the future.
Thanks, Cindy, for your call. Let's go to Judy in Racine. Hi.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for all you do. I saw you on Bill Moyer's program about Wendell Berry.
Yes.
And that was great. Can you tell people about that section or that film that you did about the bees?
Yeah.
Everybody should see that. That was great.
Yeah, it's worth going to watch the whole tape, I think, of this Moyer's show last week. And I'm sure it's online somehow, since everything's online.
Yes, it
somehow.
Is. it was
all about Wendell Berry. You know, my favorite of writers and really our great American prophet in many ways, a great man. But they did at the end, they had a little extra time, so they put in this beautiful 4 or 5 minute film of the honeybees, and it was made last year with a brand new camera that somehow lets them capture the, you know, I mean, you can see each individual wing beat, you know, of the bees. It's unbelievable. I did a little narration for it just because I like bees so much. And it was it's well worth going to see. And it's well worth, if you remember nothing else from this hour, well worth going to read some Wendell Berry if you haven't done
it. I haven't read him in a while.
He's the guy.
He's the guy, yeah. You are too, I think. Judy, thanks very much for the call. Deborah in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, I just want to state my case that I am pro-nature and pro-saving the planet. But I think people need an alternative. I mean, where will we get our oil from? Will we depend forever on other countries? And I wanted to tell you about a little like vision I had. Like it was about 10 years ago, and I imagine us sucking up the humans sucking every little. I imagine the planet as like a balloon, and we're constantly sucking up all the natural resources, and inside the integrity of the planet is collapsing. And I thought, well, this is just like in my imagination, but I wonder in reality, what does happen? I mean, do the natural resources replenish themselves, or when we suck them out, are they gone forever?
Well, that's a good question. So, and it depends on forever depends on your definition of time, I guess. So, nature is good at taking, you know, rearranging things. So we put all this carbon in the atmosphere now, and over very deep time, it'll slowly be returned underground, you know. Trees and things will soak up some of that carbon, and then they'll rot and get buried in sandstone, and there'll be new geological epochs, and you know, 50 million years from now, there'll be new pools of gas and coal and oil and things. Whether there'll be any humans around to make any use of them is an entirely different question, because we operate on a different time scale, and we're changing things at an extraordinarily fast rate. What the scientists tell us is that this is the equivalent of what happened, you know, I mean, they're expecting extinctions, for instance, this century, of maybe 50-75% of species. On this scale of what happened the last time a huge asteroid slammed into the Earth about 75 million years ago. But this time the asteroid is us, you know, and we don't have to do it. That's the pity of it. I mean, I think in a way climate change is, I mean, viewed in one sense, it's a kind of test of whether the big brain was actually a good adaptation or not, or whether it's connected to a big enough heart to kind of get us out of the trouble it got us into. We'll find out. At the moment, we're not doing too well on this test, but we haven't been told to put down our pencils quite yet. That moment may be coming, and it may be coming sooner than we want. But as long as there's some reason to fight, a lot of people will.
Thanks, Deborah, for the call. Bill McKibben is our guest. His latest book is Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He is speaking tonight. I have too many papers in front of me. It's 7 o'clock. Hold on. I got the right paper right here. 7 o'clock tonight, and it's at the Oconomowoc Arts Center. Books and Company presenting him tonight at 7 o'clock.
Can I just say it's really fun to say the word Oconomowoc?
Isn't it? I went for a walk in Oconomowoc. Somebody wrote a song about that, but I don't know how to sing it. I went
it's
for
a
walk
terrific
in Oconomowoc.
Name.
It is a good name.
Milwaukee's
a
pretty good name, too, yeah. It must be said.
Just it is
in
nice.
General, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good city, too. So let's go back to, because her statement begs the question of how else we can live, and let's go back to Kirk for a moment, whose story astounds me, because Kirk lives off the grid, and he's living on almost nothing. It's unbelievable.
Well, I mean, he says, I've built my business up, and I gross 50 grand a year, and I feel like I'm living like a king, you know? And
right.
He is. I mean, he has great, healthy food to eat. He's got all the books he needs. He's got the radio. He's got solar panels that provide all the power he uses, wants to use. And he's got a woodlot out there. I mean, it's a good life, and it's worked really hard to make it that way. But, of course, the best part of the life for him is the hard work. He likes what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are not that many people. I don't know many people more content with their lot than he is.
Mm-hmm. So can many of us make that switch, Bill? Would it be really hard?
It would not be a good idea for everyone to move to Vermont and keep bees.
I couldn't do that. No.
Well, and also there, you just would run out of space, you know. But everybody can do it in where they are in their particular ways and to the degree that they can. We can make large changes. Some of them are very easy. I mean, look, we live in a society that wastes a lot of energy and a prodigious amount of energy. Just basic conservation, if we put our minds to it as a society, would be relatively easy. I mean, the first 20% or something, I mean, it'd be like losing weight by getting a haircut. I mean, we wouldn't even notice that we were, what was happening. So I think the possibilities are there. I think the questions are far more about whether we can overcome the forces, and they're mostly in the fossil fuel industry, that are just demanding that we stick with the status quo no matter what and are willing to do anything, spend anything, subvert our democracy in every possible way to make sure that they're able to get every last dollar out of their coal mines and oil wells.
Bill McKibben, our guest, and we're welcoming more phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. The second hour of our program today, we're going to be speaking with the co-curators of the exhibit that will open on Friday at the Milwaukee Art Museum. KP and I had a chance to be guided through this yesterday morning, and it's really lovely. It's paintings by Thomas Sully. He's one of the 19th century American most prolific artists, did like thousands of works, and we know probably him best if you look at the $20 bill and Andrew Jackson. That's Sully's work, but he did so many beautiful, beautiful paintings, some reflecting the issues of his time. So we'll speak with the co-curators, hour two of our show. Bill McKibben is here now, and our phones are filled, so call, so send an email if you can't get through on the phone. That's talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And just a thought, those of you who are listening to this hour may be interested in tomorrow's hour with the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. The executive director of Food and Water Watch will be joining us tomorrow.
And Food and Water Watch.
Oh, you know about it.
Food and Water Watch and Winona Hodder, they're terrific. Say hi to Winona when she comes in.
They're doing remarkable
work, including being on the front lines of the fight against fracking in much of the country. Because you know what? The folly of using in dry parts of this country huge quantities of limited water in order to flush some more hydrocarbons out of the ground is pathetic. When we were talking about realism before, water's about as real as it gets, mm-hmm.
Yeah. David is next in Ironwood. Hello.
I listened to a university professor from Madison, and she said she calculated 160 pounds per person per day from the oil wells, farm fields, coal mines, to the store, to the landfill, that our economy. And she said most of that could probably be recycled. And she pointed out that if you could capture all the sunlight falling on Wisconsin, it could probably power the globe. So, it's hope. We can have a recycling, clean energy economy, and we wouldn't have to suffer a standard of living. But if we keep doing this, we're destroying nature's ability. I mean, nature upcycles, taking crap and making plants and life out of it. If we destroy that, we're all in trouble.
Yeah.
Yep, I think caller hits it on the head. A different vision of how you do things. Energy from above, not energy from below. The Methodist in me is tempted to make some reference to heaven and hell at this point. I don't know whether we're headed for hell, but at the current trajectory, we're certainly going someplace of a similar temperature.
Let's go next to Terry Kenosha. Hi.
Hi, I have a question regarding wind turbines and the other entities on the other side of the issue who may be opposed to building those kinds of products that would allow us to
All right, Terry, your phone is lousy. Can you get closer or something?
Oh, sure. Can you hear me now?
A little better. Go ahead.
Okay. So with wind turbines, my question is, other entities such as like Audubon Society would rather us not put wind turbines out because they're concerned about migratory birds. So what do you do about entities on the other side of the coin that are going to prohibit us from leaving fossil fuel and building alternatives?
I think that the big environmental groups like Audubon have now basically come around and said, you know, we should be careful about where we site these things. But they understand that the far, far, far greater threat to birds and everything else is the rapid heating of the planet we're now undergoing. That doesn't mean that there's not lots of local opposition. And I think in most part it comes from people who don't want to look at wind turbines. That's certainly been the case in Vermont where I live. And, you know, at this point, I think that all one can do is say, look, there's no perfection here, but this comes a lot closer than blowing the tops off people's mountains to get at the coal underneath and then filling the air with carbon. We need to have a new aesthetic along with the new engineering. I mean, I think we better get used to the idea that there's something beautiful about a windmill blade turning, the kind of breeze made visible, as it were.
Bob in Tulsa, hi.
Good afternoon. I've got a concern about the action that President Obama is going to take on this Keystone Pipeline situation, especially after reading the recent New Yorker article on said topic. My concern stems from the fact that after he was elected, Obama turned around and appointed people from Wall Street to bail out the financial industry. And I'm afraid that given his track record, I'm afraid that he's not going to put the proper people in place or give the proper people in government now the authority to pull the reins in on the oil industry.
I'm afraid of that.
Pessimistic.
I'm afraid of that, too. That's why we ran the largest demonstration of the Obama administration, and we need you out there helping us next time, and we might even need you going to jail with us. I'm afraid that's what it's going to take. Look, you know, electing Barack Obama at least gave us an opportunity to fight. When the Keystone Pipeline being a good example, Mitt Romney, his first campaign commercial said that the first act in office he would do was approve the Keystone Pipeline. And then he added, if I need to, I will build it myself, which is, if you think about Mitt Romney, a kind of charming image. I mean, you know, this end of the shovel goes in the ground, Mr. Romney. You know, there's no guarantees with Obama. You're probably right that the odds remain against us. But that's, you know, it's a fight well worth having. So don't despair about it. Fight about it.
Thank you, Bob. Ken in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question regarding the profit motive for an alternative to petroleum. I often wonder, why aren't we involving the existing oil companies? They have the infrastructure. If something would have to be distributed, they already have that distribution. And ironically, the only person I've heard talk about this as a national emergency along the lines of needing a Manhattan Project is Mike Huckabee, of all people. And we really are, I think, at that point. Why aren't we doing this?
Well, look, the oil industry, the reason we're not doing it is because the oil industry is making so much money what they're doing now, selling oil, that they've been able to effectively block change in Washington. The minute we get a serious price on carbon, then the fossil fuel industry will start becoming the energy industry, and the vision you outline will start to take place. These guys could be a part of the solution, but they won't be until we're able to rattle their business model. That's why, if you're an alumni of a college, would you make sure that your college isn't investing in fossil fuel? Someone just gave me a $50,000 prize, some Norwegians. So I said, oh, I think I'll donate this to Middlebury College in Vermont, where I'm on the faculty. But it's coming with a note that says, hold this in escrow until you divested from fossil fuel.
Oh, Bill. What was the prize for? Congratulations. That's kind of nice.
It was great. It was called the Sophie Prize.
Oh, sure.
And it's that guy who wrote that book, Sophie's World, years ago, took the money made from it and gives out a prize each year. And for me, of course, it was particularly pleasant because my one and only child is a beautiful daughter named Sophie. So there you are. It was good fun for me.
We needed it in this show on a positive note. Bill McKibben, go get him.
Thank you so much, friend.
He'll be in Oconomowoc tonight, 7 o'clock, Books and Company at the Oconomowoc Arts Center. And he'll be good to listen to further. His book, his latest book is Bill McKibben, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll be on this issue again if you didn't get through today. Don't worry. We've talked about it quite a bit. Stay with us for the next hour of our program when we're going to the world of art and a beautiful exhibit that's opening on Friday at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Thanks for listening to this hour. News is coming up on the Ideas Network.